Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Pudge Kleinkopf, and she'll be answering your most important questions on Alaska's other fish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form. But when we return, we'll be talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about Alaska's other fish. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work, on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before I introduce Pudge, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away, and we've got a lot tonight. For a drawing tonight, we're going to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and thanks to Pudge, a copy of her book, Fly Fishing, Women Explore Alaska, with an accompanying hat and fly box, and also a copy of her other book, River Girls, Fly Fishing for Young Women, with its accompanying hat and fly box. So you have 4 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Pudge's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners near the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate, which can be redeemed for any merchandise at the Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, either in their shop or online at their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question is going to be about something we've talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So the same place that you can ask questions during the show is where you will answer this question at the end of the show. So listen closely and use your best typing skills at the end to send that final answer to win that $20 gift certificate from Front Range Anglers. Well, our guest tonight is Cecilia Kleinkopf, better known as Pudge. And Pudge is a retired university professor and lawyer, a longtime fly fisher, has owned and operated women's fly fishing for 20 years. She offers lodge-based fly fishing schools and small group guided trips throughout Alaska for salmon, trout, grayling, char, and pike. She also leads saltwater fly fishing trips to Mexico each year and offers a fly fishing school in conjunction with the John Campbell Folk School in North Carolina. Pudge took the winning sailfish in 2005 Sails and Tails Fly Fishing Tournament in Zihuatanejo, Mexico, and is scheduled to lead a fly fishing school for women in Swedish Lapland in July of 2006, which she's already done, I'm sure. She serves on the pro staff for Mustad Hooks, Ross Reels, and Patagonia. Pudge is a regular presenter and fly tire at outdoor shows in Alaska, California, and Washington, and she's been featured in the Anchorage Daily News and is one of the special explorers for the Alaska Magazine television series on PBS. She's also a board member of the International Women Fly Fishers. Pudge is the author of Fly Fishing Women Explore Alaska, from Epicenter Press, and also River Girls Fly Fishing for Young Women from Johnson Press. She also serves as a contributing editor for Fish Alaska Magazine. Fudge, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks for having me back, Roger. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, and the last time Fudge was on, we had a panel of three women talking about women in fly fishing, and that was about a year ago, I think, now. It seems like a long time ago, but we're happy to have you back. And you get the whole stage this time, Fudge.
Wow, I can hardly wait.
Well, let's tonight we're going to talk about Alaska's other fish, and by that we mean everything but salmon. Alaska is so well known for the salmon, but we thought it'd be nice to talk about all the other kinds of fish that you can fish for up there, many of which are trophies in their own right, and a lot of people just don't understand the variety that's available up there. So we're going to explore that tonight, talk about where to fish up there, what kind of fish are there, and how to fish for them, and hopefully we'll leave some time at the end, Pudge, for some tips about trip planning up there and what people need to do. So,
okay.
Can we give them a geography lesson here, Pudge? Because Alaska is so big, and I, having lived in Anchorage when I was a kid, know that the access is somewhat limited to most of the state. So could you kind of give us a lay of the different regions and then maybe how those regions are accessed as well from a fly fishing standpoint?
Sure, Roger. It's probably best to start with one of Alaskans' favorite jokes, which is not a joke, and that is that if you took Alaska and you cut it in half, then each half would still be larger than Texas. And when you get your brain around that concept, you begin to understand this whole, this massive area that's up here. And while it provides enormous opportunities for us and really a variety that's just staggering, it is also difficult to access. There's Anchorage is the main city, of course, and if you all can kind of picture Alaska in your head, it's got like the big mass of land kind of with two tails coming out. One tail goes down into what's called the Aleutian Chain, and the other tail goes down to southeast Alaska, which kind of borders Canada as you head towards Seattle. So kind of right in the middle of that arc between those two tails is the city of Anchorage, and that's the largest city in the state. It's not our capital, however. Our capital is in Juneau, which is in the southeast part of the state. Now, out of Anchorage, there's pretty much one road north and one road south. The road north goes toward Fairbanks, which is the second largest city in the state, and then the road south heads down to the very world-famous Kenai Peninsula. Now, if you go east and west, you've got to get there out of Anchorage or Fairbanks by plane, or at times, sometimes, maybe perhaps by boat. But there are no roads. Now, once you get into, like, western Alaska, which is the area that includes the famous Bristol Bay that I think is so world-renowned for its huge rainbow trout, and then also the area of like the Alaska Peninsula up toward Nome and Kotzebue into really rural Alaska and really northern Alaska, even much of it above the Arctic Circle. Once you get into some of those places, there may be a few roads around the towns or the villages, but they don't connect to, which is part of the problem, they don't connect to any of the roads that like would go north or south from Anchorage. So you're actually stuck with having to get out to someplace, a hub, let's say in Bristol Bay, like the little town of King Salmon or the town of Dillingham, and then go out from there. Now, even from those hubs, there won't necessarily be many roads out to any place else. So it's kind of like you get out of Anchorage or Fairbanks on perhaps a larger plane, then you get into some of those hubs, and then often you get onto the small planes and the float planes and sometimes the little, two-seater Piper Cubs that'll take you out into other regions. Now, when you go down to southeastern Alaska, there is more connectivity there by boat and by water, and that's where the majority of the state of Alaska's ferry system operates, which is in that area, and it's kind of considered by people who live in the southeast part of the state to be sort of the water highway of the southeast part of the state. But still, there are not roads down there, and you may get places by the ferry or by boat, and then still often have to take a smaller boat to get in somewhere or have to fly.
So it's not particularly a place you can, other than the Kenai there, drive around and fish in areas because everything's so remote, which is kind of the good part about Alaska, too, that it is
yes,
still
it
remote
is. Mm-hmm.
And protected. I know when I was living up there, like I said, as a kid, and we drove up the Alcan Highway, and it was dirt back then, and then I went up there fishing a few years ago, and then they had paved the road, and now it seems like everybody's driving up there. But back then, it was quite the adventure to get up there. And so that road in the Kenai can get quite crowded as well, so all the more reason to fly in to other places
true.
As well,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Okay, now, what areas then would you say are, above Anchorage, there's that whole expanse of the state. I mean, most of the state is above Anchorage, it seems like.
Yes.
But what are the more popular regions that people will go fish in?
Well, around the Fairbanks area, there's some very good, there's a lot of Arctic grayling fishing there. There's a whole area called the Minto Flats that has fantastic pike fishing, absolutely fantastic pike fishing. And so those are areas that people who've been to kind of what's called the interior, the mid part of Alaska, will know and know, you know, more of the fishing in that area. As I mentioned earlier, Bristol Bay. Now, Bristol Bay is in the western, kind of the southwestern part of Alaska, but not so far south that you're heading down the Aleutian chain. Then, as I say, kind of west then of Bristol Bay is the area of the Togiak River and the Kuskokwim River, and those are some wonderful fisheries as well. Then as you go north, as I said, that's Norton Sound and the Alaska Peninsula, which is the area around Nome, and you keep going farther and you'll get up into Kotzebue. And then if you were to head up just straight up north from Fairbanks, you could go up along the pipeline, the highway to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which is called the Dalton Highway, but people just refer to it as the Hall Road. There's fishing along that road, but there's nothing there. I mean, there's not towns, there's not villages, there's not gas stations, there's not, it's just a haul road, really, up to the pipeline. And there's been various debates over the years about, you know, opening that road or, you know, making it more friendly, user-friendly by, you know, letting people put gas stations along the road and whatnot. But pretty much it's now still, it's a road that it's really not smart to, like, think you can get in your motorhome or your camper and drive up there from Fairbanks and get to the pipeline. But there is fishing along that road as well. And then you get over to east of Anchorage or northeast or east and north of Fairbanks, and you've got the whole area that is, part of it is the waterway that kind of people think of in there is the Yukon River. So there's that area of Alaska, which is really the Yukon. Then as you go down towards southeast, again, in the arc, is what's called the outer coast. And there you've got the towns of Cordova and Yakutat and Whittier. They're somewhat served by the ferry system. But that's an area that has got a lot of saltwater fishing. Many people don't know that the state of Alaska all by itself has more coastal mileage, more coastal area than all the rest of the lower 49 states put together. So there you're going to have a lot of access to, you know, halibut fishing and salmon coming into the streams. See, and then as you go down into southeastern Alaska, then you've got some very famous areas down there. The area around Ketchikan is really very well known. There's good steelhead fishing there, although the runs are small, but there's a lot of small streams that will have steelhead down there.
Well, just so much fishing to be had. And I guess
yep.
In all the areas you mentioned, or most of them, there are lodges and camps, as I should say, because one of the places we went was kind of a tent camp on an island, mm-hmm. platform tent kind of things. Or the other thing that people have the option to do is floating some of the rivers and camping out. So all kinds of ways to explore up there. Well, let's talk about before we get into the fish, there is a question here from Michael Norton in Binghamton, New York. And Michael asks, with Alaska being so known for its abundant salmon runs, what made you start to target other species that are there? My guess is just love of fly fishing in the outdoors, but what's your answer, Pudge?
Well, Michael, you're pretty right. There is, you know, there's abundant salmon runs, but there's lots and lots of other wonderful fish as well. And, you know, many people make the mistake of thinking that in Alaska we have all of the salmon in all of the rivers all of the time, and that's simply not true. We have some of the salmon in some of the rivers part of the time is a little more like it. So people who, you know, only want salmon fishing can find that, and they truck around the state. They'll fly different places, and they'll you know, time the runs, because many of the salmon runs are earlier in southeast Alaska than they are, you know, in Bristol Bay or South Central. And if that's what you want, then that's what you can do. But it's kind of silly, and many people can't afford to go flying around, you know, to find where the kings are running right now. And so then people want to fish for, you know, what's in their backyard as well, which will be trout and grayling and char and pike and sometimes steelhead, and if you're far north enough, sheafish, and there's just lots of other things which are really all very intriguing to me, and really get you to different parts of Alaska and learning different kinds of skills, and it's just, for me, it's fascinating to learn about, you know, the different kinds of species and you know, how you fish for them and what kind of flies work and stuff like that.
Why don't you, Pudge, why don't you run down the laundry list of those other fish that you can catch in Alaska, no matter, you know, where in the state it might be. I realize they're not all in one place, but what is that laundry list?
Well, probably, you know, most people, they think of salmon first, and then after they're done with that, the very next thing they think of is rainbow trout, because, of course, you know, some of the world's trophy rainbow trout come from Alaska. So, and then if you stay in the trout species, many people don't realize Alaska does not have brown trout. There are no brown trout in Alaska. So we have rainbow trout. We have cutthroat trout. Cutthroat trout are only in the southeast part of the state. The waters just get too cold for them as you come up, you know, into South Central and as you go north. We have a few little brook trout scattered here and there that were planted apparently years ago by U.S. Fish and Wildlife, but never really took. So for all intents and purposes, we don't consider that we have any brook trout in Alaska. But we do have lake trout. We have wonderful lake trout fishing and some very, very large lake trout around the state as well. So that kind of gets you in the trout species. Then we have steelhead as well in Alaska, although we don't have as many places in the lower 48 do. We don't have summer steelhead. We don't have summer runs of steelhead. Most of our steelhead runs, we have a few that are spring runs and then some that are fall runs, but we have no summer steelhead. So then we have, though, two kinds of char in Alaska. One is called Dolly Varden char, and that name came from the colorfulness of the fish. Apparently, someone named them for a character in a Dickens novel who was apparently a flamboyant actress with the name of Dolly Varden. And believe it, it's not, you wouldn't believe how many people think it's Dolly Parton. And they even emailed me and asked me about, what's this Dolly Parton fish you've got up there?
Oh,
anyway, so that's one of our two char, and then the other are Arctic char. And biologists are just beginning to understand those two and begin to be able to differentiate between them. Okay, so then we've got really my favorite fish in Alaska, which is the Arctic grayling, which really only exists now in pretty much in Canada and in Alaska. And certainly some of your listeners, Roger, probably are well aware. I think it's just the recent issue of Fly Rod and Reel magazine, and then on their website they have a very nice article about the efforts that have taken place in Montana to try to preserve that very tiny, tiny run of wild, truly wild Arctic grayling that are in Montana. But otherwise, they Arctic grayling have just pretty much been wiped out everywhere else. All right, so then we've got sheafish, which I mentioned, and which many people are not familiar with at all. The sheafish is a true wilderness fish. You don't see those in the rivers that are easily accessed. The sheafish are very hard to find. They're way, way up north, but boy, are they fun on a fly rod. So we can come back and talk a little bit about those later. Now, we also have northern pike, and a lot of people just, you know, don't pay attention or think much about, you know, that Alaska would have a fish like pike. But we do, and we have a lot of them, frankly, in a lot of places. And I happen to be one that loves to fish for pike on a fly rod. So I love to fish for most anything on a fly rod. But, so that kind of gets you down the list of you know, like what else we've got up here.
Okay. Well, let's talk about each of these more specifically. And let's do that right after I take a little commercial break here. And then we'll dive in. Okay, Pudge?
Okay.
Flat River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com, so that's like for Wyoming, wyotrout.com, or call Platte River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about Alaska's other fish. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Pudge, before, and we did have a question come in here while we were talking, which I'll get to in just a minute, but tell us, before we dive into the fish, tell us a little bit about what you do for business up there, and tell us about your two books that you've written.
All right. Well, very briefly, my business is called Women's Fly Fishing. It's an instruction and guide service that had its, actually it's had its 21st birthday this summer, so I said it became an adult this summer. I don't do kind of traditional guiding. I organize small groups of women and couples and lead them on guided trips to 12, 14 different places around Alaska during the summer. So that's, you know, my primary business. I also, as Roger said with my introduction, I also lead groups a couple of times a year, usually for saltwater fly fishing in Mexico. Then for many years, people kept saying to me, you know, you should write a book. And I thought, I don't know how to write a book. But I went and found out. Actually, I took a workshop about, you know, how to get published, and it changed my life, absolutely. So my first book, Fly Fishing Women Explore Alaska, is kind of the compilation of a lot of the stories of women that I've taught to fly fish and have taken fly fishing and guided. And it focuses on six of my favorite, very favorite locations to fly fish in the state of Alaska. With, as I say, the women telling the stories and having the pictures of the big fish. So that book came out in 2003. And then in 2006, my second book came out. That's a book that I wrote with the help of four real live girls whom I have helped to start to fly fish. So those girls I thought would be great examples and models for other girls to show girls that, you know, fly fishing isn't just a sport for guys or boys. It's a sport for girls and for women as well. So this way they've got four real girls to read about. And so the girls tell their story, and then they help me. They commented on all of the different chapters in the book. Now, both of those books, I'm very proud to say, are award winners. The Independent Publishers Association of the United States offers a book award contest every year called the Benjamin Franklin Awards. And they have about a dozen categories of different kinds of books. Well, in the Sports and Recreation book, Fly Fishing Women Explore Alaska won the second place award in 2004. And then this year, River Girls won the gold, won the first place award in the Benjamin Franklin Book Award. So I'm pretty pleased about that. And I'm also pleased that one of the questions, I think, was about the girls' book as well. River Girls is really meant for families, for teachers, for fly fishing clubs, for everybody to use to help convince girls that fly fishing's a wonderful sport for them. So I'm pretty proud of both of my books.
Well, you should be, and congratulations on those awards. That's great. That's great. Well, why don't you give everybody your web address, your website address, so that they have
okay.
that.
Okay. It's www. And it's women's with an E, so it's WOMENS fly fishing. So it's WOMENSFLYFISHING, and it's .net.
.net, okay. Mm-hmm. And we do have a link to that on Pudge's speakers page on our website, as well as a link to her two books there that you can get out through Amazon or through Pudge's website as well. So if you would want something, I suppose, Pudge, signed or autographed, then they need to contact you direct to get something.
They can get them off the website. River Girls, the River Girls book has its own website as well, rivergirlsflyfishing.com. And either or both of those sites can order books and then the hats and fly boxes that go with them. And then they can use PayPal to pay. So then I send the book out so I can autograph it for people too.
Terrific, terrific. Well, okay, let's talk about fishing. One of the questions that came back in while we were talking was from Donna Parrish in Burlington, Vermont, and she wants to know, what is the most exciting species of fish for you to catch in Alaska?
Well, you know, it's hard to pick one, but we've got so many. She fish probably, I think, is an exciting fish just because it's so unique. And it's so hard to, there's a saying about she fish that you have to, before you can fish them, you have to find them. They are migratory, and they're never pretty much, I mean, they're during the fishing season, they're never in one place. They go from the estuary where they spend the winter of these huge rivers in Alaska. They go all the way to the headwaters of that river and spawn, and then turn around and come all the way back down again in one fishing season. So finding them is half of the battle with sheafish, but they're an interesting fish. They're distantly related to tarpon, believe it or not, and they are all referred to often as the tarpon of the north. They actually have a flat, large gill plate like a tarpon, and they have a kind of scales that are similar to a tarpon scale. So they're pretty exciting, just partly because, you know, they're very, very unique. Then I'm a steelhead fisher, and I love steelhead fishing as well. I love the challenge of steelhead. They're the kind of fish that really, I think, tests an angler's mettle, and you know, because you have to be patient, and you have to learn what you're doing, and they're not an easy fish, and I think I like that. But and then I guess so my third, I got three favorites really, and my third favorite, pretty above all of them and most everything else, is Arctic grayling, because they're so underappreciated.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I'm kind of jumping around here, but let's, because you said so much about sheafish already, let's continue with that as one of our topics here for a minute. And
okay.
Nico in Italy, which is very, we do have an international audience, and but this question came from Italy, so and he wants to know, where do you fish for sheafish? I think you just said only north, right? Or you want to be more specific?
Way north, yes. The Kobuk River and the Kuskokwim River. Now, the Kuskokwim is not, I mean, the Kobuk River is a lot farther north, if you look at a map of Alaska, than the Kuskokwim River is. But they are both large rivers, and you know, they both are a whole lot farther north than, you know, like Anchorage. And so they both happen to be rivers that have the kind of habitat that she fish like. And so, but what she fish do is they travel up those big rivers, and then they'll stop to rest at the mouths of tributaries pouring into those rivers. But then they go clear the headwaters and spawn and turn around and come back down. So what people do is you kind of hunt them, really. You know kind of where they typically are in a year, like in July, in which areas of the river, and then you just go and take an 8-weight and go look for them. And while you're looking, you catch actually a lot of incidental pike and usually some other fish as well. But what will happen with shefish is you'll find them, and boy, you'll have just whiz-bang fishing for sometimes several hours. And then all of a sudden, it's like someone turned off the light switch and they're gone. And so then you're on the hunt again, and you just keep on going upriver, and, see if you can find them again. Now, some people recommend that you fish them in the fall. And I don't think that's necessarily because they're any more available in the fall. It's just that the water in the rivers is lower in the fall, and so I think it might be in some places easier to pursue them.
Now, and when they are moving, are they in a school, so to speak? So you get into one, and then you get into many. Is that what you were referring to?
Pretty typically. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, the schools aren't. I mean, they'll be smaller. There'll be smaller schools. Some are larger. They'll move, but they move in groups, and they just go in kind of waves. Up the rivers.
So they're only in the rivers, not in lakes.
Right.
And then, how big do they get?
Well, the state record is 41 pounds. I looked that up. I was preparing kind of for tonight, and I went and checked out, all the state records here. Those aren't necessarily on a fly, but the state record shefish is, I'm looking at the wrong fish. It's 53 pounds.
53.
Mm-hmm. But they're pretty routinely 50-pound fish caught in the Kobuk River.
That's a nice fish, yeah.
That's a beauty of a fish. Yeah.
And you said it sounded like you were indicating that it's available throughout the from spring to fall. So is that the case?
Well, they're available, somewhere in their river system.
Right. So, but to find them, basically, you need a good guide.
That's right, and a good boat, right? And a lot of patience and dedication, because they'll rest, as I say, at the mouths often of some of the tributary streams, and occasionally they'll stray up that tributary a ways, but they pretty much come back down and then go on to where they're going to spawn. So,
then,
but once you find them, then you just kind of try to follow them.
And then how do you fish for them?
Well, they like white. They're a fish that likes white flies. Not that they won't take a lot of other colors, but the times that I fish for them and all the people I know who fish for them just really pretty much say, any like a big, usually like a 2-1-0, 2-0 size hook, white with lots of flash, lots of crystal flash, lots of flashaboo. I'll use a very narrow saddle hackle in a make a long tail out of them, and that seems to be a fly of a color that they like. They don't particularly like fly strip necessarily really fast. We just kind of vary how we strip for them, and once you're in a school of them, they'll take quite eagerly.
And are you fishing there with floating lines or intermediate or sinking line?
I prefer a floating line, although sometimes we do fish intermediate. Often there, it's not really necessary to have, like a 200 grain lead core sinking tip line. It's really not usually necessary to go that deep.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about shefish that people would like to know?
No, well, they're a really interesting fish, and the other thing I should tell people is, if some people always like to go, if they've got an IGFA record book, and look up different fish and what the record is, but the shefish's correct name is Inkanu, and it's a native name for them. So if you go look them up in the IGFA record book, you won't find them under shefish. You'll find them under Inkanu.
How do you spell that?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I should have written it down. It's Inkanou or something like that. Yeah, okay. It's I-N-N. That's what it starts with. It's Inkanou.
And is that a fish that natives eat in Alaska, or is it?
Yes, they do. Yes,
oh, okay.
That's quite a subsistence fish, and they catch them in their subsistence nets very frequently. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Great. Sounds exciting. Sounds a lot like tropical tarpon fishing. The hunt, the strip.
Well, and they jump like tarpon. They're not called tarpon of the north for nothing. They look like tarpon.
Really?
They take like tarpon, and they jump like tarpon. Yep.
Oh, great. Sounds exciting. And pretty much to fish for those, I guess, when you go in, are you at camps up there, or are you on a river float? No, you wouldn't be on a float because you said you had to run up and down river.
But. Yeah, except you could float. I mean, you could go upriver of, you know, where some of the good tributary, you know, holding spots are, and then work your way down. See, the problem is if you found them, the fish would be going upriver and you'd be going downriver, so you'd have a small problem there.
So you've got guides up there that you can stay
Yeah, there
with.
Are guides up there. They're not a lot. There's not a lot of sport fishing for them, believe it or not. And I've always thought that was because they are hard to find.
Yeah. Well, that's a challenge for a lot of
mm-hmm.
people like that challenge.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about rainbow trout, because that's another big love of fly fishers in Alaska. They're so beautiful up there and big. So,
they are.
Where are the rainbow trout found most prominently?
Well, they're found everywhere. But what you have to realize, again, because of Alaska's massive size, by the time you get to Fairbanks, you're not going to find any more rainbow trout.
Okay.
It gets too cold for them. And as you go towards southeast Alaska, toward Juneau and Ketchikan and Petersburg, you're not going to find any rainbow trout much down there either. The habitat isn't to their liking. So for rainbow trout, you're going to be mostly in on the Kenai Peninsula and then western Alaska. So the Bristol Bay region is the area of the primo, absolutely primo area of Alaska if what you want is rainbow trout and big rainbow trout and beautiful. All wild rainbow trout.
Yeah, the pictures you see of those fish are incredible up there. Amazes me. And they're always big, heavy, muscular. They're not these skinny things that we get down
here
sometimes.
Well, we never take pictures of the skinny ones.
There are skinny ones.
Big-shouldered ones, yeah.
Yeah. They all look like they lift weights, you know, in their spare
mm-hmm.
time or whatever.
I think some of them do. Well, you remember, we have a food source, and we can talk about this more later because it's, I think, something that you and I talked about, Roger, that, you know, we might talk about tonight.
Yeah, go ahead.
We got a food source here that fish in the lower 48 haven't got, and that's salmon eggs. And so, you know, that's what turned these big rainbows into football players, is an abundance of food of salmon eggs and rotting salmon flesh. That's pure protein. They absolutely, when it's available in the rivers where they live, those who live in those rivers, just absolutely gorge on that. And that's what brings that kind of size.
And so do they, they're also in lakes as well up there. Where the lakes are attached to rivers, do they move down into the rivers to feed on salmon roe and so forth when the run?
Yes, and then sometimes until it's interesting in a number of lakes, then they'll go back into the lakes. Like Naknek Lake is a very famous lake, and people always ask, they say, well, where are the biggest rainbow trout found in Alaska? And usually people refer to the big three rivers in Alaska as the Nooshigak, the Naknek, and the Kwajak. Now, all three of those rivers are in Bristol Bay, and they produce some of the most enormous rainbow trout you can just ever imagine. But like Naknek River and Naknek Lake is a very good example. The rainbows come out of, or they'll be in the tributary streams in the spring for spawning. And then the salmon will enter the streams. And so then when, like if the sockeye run is a heavy run, then the trout will, the sockeye actually kind of run them off as well. But then the trout will fall back and hang out back in the lake until and often around the mouth until the salmon eggs start coming down and out into the lake. And then the trout will re-enter the rivers to start directly feeding on the salmon eggs.
Okay.
So they're in obviously both rivers and lakes, and they're caught in rivers and lakes, and some of the big trout in like Naknek Lake, they say will really never go into they stay in the lake all year.
And what's a good size rainbow in Alaska in these areas?
Well, let me look here. I've got it right in front of me. The state record is 42 pounds, 3 ounces.
Oh, my God.
No, doesn't that just blow your mind?
Yeah, I can't even think about that. I mean, picture
I know.
That.
Well, and they certainly aren't all that
yeah.
size.
But because, the average fly fisher that comes to Alaska, what can he expect to catch?
Well, see, that's a really hard question to answer because it's going to depend on what river they're on.
Right.
What time of year it is, if they're using the right stuff, if they're using the little beads or the little egg flies that imitate the salmon eggs, if that's what's in the river, they're gonna do a lot better than someone who in the midst of the salmon eggs is still using nymphs. An occasional fish will take the nymphs, but pretty much, while that food source is around, the salmon eggs, that's what they're eating. But I would say it's not uncommon for people to catch, and fairly routinely, 20, 25-inch fish.
Wow.
Most, I think, in a lot of the places, where you can fish. As I said, given all those other things, that you're in the right place at the right time and,
right.
Using the right gear.
And is there a season for any fish in Alaska, or is it open up there?
Oh, no. There are seasons.
Okay.
Many of the rivers. I just had an email from folks here a couple days ago, and they want to come in early June because they want to come and fish for king salmon, and then they want to know, where the rainbows are, where the rainbow fishing is. And I said, well, unfortunately, a lot of the rivers are closed to protect the, our rainbows spawn in the spring, just like rainbows everywhere. And so, a lot of the rivers are going to be closed until the 10th, 12th, maybe 15th, something like that, of June to protect the spawning fish. So, I told them they're going to have to really check their regulations to, find some of the rivers that, that it will be open during the time that they're here. So
each river could have a different schedule.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay. And we got so many different rivers that you really have to pay attention to the regulations here because they'll, open or sections of them, like the Naknek River is a very good example. I mean, it closes that, I think it's the 9th of April to protect the spawning rainbows, and then in those particular areas where they spawn, then it doesn't open again until it's early June. I have to look every year because it can change from year to year as well.
Yeah.
So there are definitely, and there are seasons for the salmon, when they're open and closed, and how many, what the limits are and all of that.
Okay. We do have a question came in over the internet from Andy in Louisiana. What's the best time of year to fish for trout in Alaska? So the spring is definitely not the best time because of the regulations there. Is the rest of the summer and fall good for rainbows?
The fall is wonderful for rainbows.
Okay.
If you get on the rivers, as I say, that have big runs of salmon, or that have maybe all five species of Pacific salmon, which we can talk about in at another time, because then there's going to be a massive amount of eggs and rotting salmon flesh in the rivers, and that really is, when the big rainbows really show up. But what people don't know is that we have a couple of special hatches up here. And another one is the salmon smolt. In the spring, the salmon, the salmon stay, different, the babies stay, in the river different numbers of years. The king salmon, little ones will only stay, they may stay around, two or three years before they go out to sea. But if you know kind of where to look and what salmon are spawning, have spawned in a particular river, the spring, it's usually kind of mid-June to kind of the late part of June, that temperature has to get up in the water a little bit. And then the salmon smolt will begin to come out the rivers heading out to sea. And then pretty much all the other fish, from lake trout to char to rainbows to grayling, kind of just hang out right at the where the mouths of these creeks will feed into like the larger lakes or into larger rivers, and they just feast on those salmon smolt coming out there.
Terrific, terrific.
So the spring can be a good time too, kind of early summer, I'd say.
Yeah. Patrick in Northern California says, I hope to fish the Kenai River for the first time during mid-June 2008. Our plan is to be there as rainbow trout season opens. While we will probably drift the upper Kenai, I'd love to visit some other smaller streams to fish rainbows. Any suggestions?
Yes, Patrick, but as I said, check the regs carefully because, you know, for the opening dates and all of that. But there are several other wonderful streams down the Kenai that have rainbows. One is the Anchor River that's down on the way to Homer. And actually right near the Kenai, as you drive to the Kenai, you will go past the Russian River, which has the famous run of there's more. That's the river that has the largest run of sockeye salmon anywhere you can drive to. It's in the Kenai and Russian River. So you can fish the Russian River as well, you know, once it's open for rainbows. Then there's a little creek there called Crescent Creek. And then there's two other creeks on the way toward Homer and toward the Anchor River, which is a river I particularly like. One is called Deep Creek, and the other one is called the Nilchik River. You'll see them on the map if you look just, you know, on the Internet about the Kenai Peninsula.
Great, great. Okay, time for another little break here, Pudge, and we'll be right back. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which shares a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.family, and that's T-Y-E-S, familyties.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Sounds like Family Ties could use your River Girls book to help their youth programs there, Budge. So,
yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about Alaska's other fish. If you'd like to ask a question, just go to our homepage and fill out that Q&A box on our homepage. Send us your question, and we'll try to answer as many of them as we can tonight. Okay, let's move on, because time is always getting short whenever we do this show. Let's talk a little bit about cutthroat trout. You said they were fairly limited in Alaska as far as where we can find them.
Right. Their range is pretty much down in the southeast part of the state. We have both sea run cuts and we have resident cuts. A lot of the lakes in southeastern Alaska have resident cutthroat, you know, that live there year-round, that are not anadromous. But then we also have sea-run cuts that come in. They'll come in with the steelhead. They'll come in with the salmon runs. And so cuts are very, very available to people in the southeast part of the state. So, as I said, that you can fish them in both rivers and lakes. They pretty much take the cutthroat flies that you'd use anywhere. They're kind of partial to pink and yellow in some combinations of those. They like a little white, maybe a little bucktail wing or, you know, a little deer tail wing on them. And so they're really, they're a fish that I wish we had more of in a wider area of the state, but they really are available down in southeastern Alaska. So if you know you're going there, see a lot of people in southeastern Alaska, they'll get off the cruise ships. You know, we have thousands of people coming on the cruise ships all the time, and the cruise ships pretty much remain in the southeast part of the state. And so they'll dock for a day or so in maybe Petersburg or Ketchikan, and then people get off and do, you know, a variety of things. There's a really nice in Juneau. There's a wonderful fly shop there that, you know, can arrange just day fishing for people. So, you know, if like people really like cutthroat and want to try Alaska's cuts, then that it's Juneau Fly Goods is the name of the shop. And Brad Elfers is the owner of that shop. Really nice fellow. And, you know, he can set people up to just go fish just cuts for the day.
That's great. I hadn't really thought about that much. I mean, in the, you know, when we go on cruises down in the Caribbean, we think about going, you know, scuba diving for a day or fly fishing down there as well. But, yeah, that's great opportunities in Alaska. And a lot of those ports on the down southeast have some great fishing. What any particular time of year that you target there as far as the cuts?
Well, no, it would be more, you know, like if you're there in the spring, what you're really going to find is the cuts, probably the sea runs are following in the steelhead. And then in the lakes, you know, they would be there all the time. Now, you know, there's another really good way for people to fish cuts on the lakes. The Forest Service has a lot of cabins, remote use cabins, and the majority of them are actually in the southeast part of the state, and they're all on water of some kind, and many of them are on lakes, and the lakes have cutthroat trout in them. So if people want a nice and actually a reasonably priced vacation, we used to go to the Forest Service cabins all the time. You know, you have to provide your own food and usually and buy your oil stove if there's an oil stove there, or you have to chop your own wood. But there are many of them near or right on, like creeks or lakes, or, you know, on trails that you can, you know, hike to some fishing and really get out some nice cutthroat trout fishing in southeast Alaska.
Great, great. And I think that's something people need to ask, too, when they're thinking about going to an area, is what are these other fish that might be available? Because I know we did a fly-in trip to the Togiak, primarily, and this was the second week in August, primarily to fish for silvers. Mm-hmm. But it happened when we first got there, the silvers were just starting to come in. They were a little late, and we ended up fishing for a lot of chum salmon, which were a blast, too. But probably the best day we had was when the guy took us to a side creek, and we caught Dolly Varden. And
yeah.
we literally had to almost shake him off the hook because there were so many, and we were the only people there, and it was just a wonderful day. And I have to compliment the guide for suggesting it. Say, hey, why don't you guys take a day off and let's go do something different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were up for it and had a wonderful time. So I think if you're going somewhere, you should do just that, is ask, hey, now what are the other opportunities I might have if I'm fishing for salmon, or I can go do something else for a day, and see what's in season and what they've got available.
Absolutely. There's just, as we've talked, Roger, you and I, you know, people kind of get on their blinders when they think about Alaska. And if they think about anything else but salmon, it's always rainbow trout. And they never kind of think, oh, well, and is there anything else? Or they hardly ever ask, because dollies are probably, and we might as well talk about dollies next.
Yeah, let's do.
But our char are probably, again, the fish that is the most prevalent throughout the state. And it's around most of the time, because they'll come in, they're fall spawners, because all char are fall spawners, and so they'll come into the rivers, usually their home river, but not necessarily, and spawn, and then they'll hang around and winter over. And then in the spring, as I say, they're right there, boy, at the table, feeding on the little salmon smolt that are, you know, coming out of the rivers. But then they go on back into the salt, and then they hook up again and follow around the schools of salmon and then come back in with them. But see, in like southeast Alaska, too, just like cutthroat trout, they will follow the steelhead, you know, into a river, or you know, in the fall, when the steelhead come in, they'll you know, hang up behind them, you know, waiting for the eggs. So dollies are around all over the place. They're in Bristol Bay. There you can find them way up in some of the rivers on the North Slope. You know, see, as I said, we have two kinds. We have Dolly Varden char and we have Arctic char. And as I said earlier, the biologists are just really beginning to study them, and they're still, the only way they can really for sure tell the difference between the two species are to apparently count the gill rakers. They have to, you know, kill them and dissect them and count the gill rakers. And but they're beginning to learn more and more about them. And this is a generalization, but for the most part, they believe that the majority, not all, but the majority of Arctic char are resident fish. They are not anadromous. They do not go to sea and come back. They will stay in their own home river or their home, you know, river and lake system. And that the ones that go to sea and come back are the Dolly Varden char. And because in some rivers, the char just get huge. And people assume that, you know, or they like to think those are Arctic char. I think it's partly because Arctic char sounds a little more glamorous than Dolly Varden char, like Dolly Parton char, right? And so people would rather think of them as Arctic char. But the fact of the matter is, if they're anadromous, they believe that the majority of fish that are anadromous are not Arctic char, they are Dolly Varden char.
And will the dollies get larger than the Arctic char because they are, because they do go?
Yes, yes, in places they do. Yes, in places they do.
Do they bulk up just like, you know, like the steelhead do?
Sure. See, they're following that. They'll come right for that food source, you know, right behind the salmon. See, that's, again, as I say, why we get rainbows the size we do and stuff is just because of, you know, those food sources. Well, the dollies come right for that as well. And what's really nice about dollies is that they're, in many cases, they're a lot more, shall we say, eager to take your fly than a rainbow. So, you know, a lot of people just kind of say, oh, Dolly Varden, or this fish with pink spots. I mean, I wouldn't want to catch a fish with pink spots. I had a couple number of years ago, and the husband in the couple said to me, well, what would I want with a fish with pink spots? And I said, well, just wait till you catch one, and then you can ask me that question again, right?
Yeah.
But they are. They're very available. And the wonderful thing about them is they're school fish. They're schoolies, by golly. When you get a bunch, you know, one, there's a million others there.
Yeah.
And if you watch the river, you can see schoolies. They show themselves to you. They flash. As they school and move and whatnot, they flash. And people will say, look, there's this flash in the water. And it's always dollies. So, you know, that's the other nice thing. Yeah, see, like your experience, you find them, and boy, then you're in seventh heaven because you can have a fish, you know, every cast practically.
Yeah, our day, I mean, I was up there with my father and my son. The three of us would have fish on all together many, many times, three hookups.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the big joke there was I was all excited because I had caught like a 26-inch dolly, and I just measured it and released it, and I said to my son Nathan, he was upriver, I said, Nathan, I caught a great fish, a 26-inch, and he goes, well, I caught a big one too, Dad, and he says, and the guy goes up and measure it, and I got beat out. It was a 27-inch fish, so there's nothing wrong with fish that size, pink spots or not, I'm telling you.
That's exactly right. They are beautiful fish, and you know, all char, whether it's, you know, Eastern brookies or cuts, you know, they all color up when they go to spawn, and the dollies are some of the most colorful. Well, I lumped the cuts with the char. That was my mistake. But the dollies get absolutely gorgeous. They get their bellies turn scarlet, just like burnt orange, just this bright burnt orange scarlet color. And their spots that during the rest of the year are pink now are also kind of burnt orange. And around their fins, their caudal fins, they get a huge white band. So often, you know, you can see them as well. You know, you look down, the river's pretty clear and not too deep. And you could spot a dolly a mile away because of the big white band that forms, you know, along their fins. And then their lips, there's actually one of the native names for them translates to something like a fish with lipstick or something. Their lips actually change in color as well. Now, the males get more colorful than the females, but they both color up in the fall. They just get beautiful.
Yeah, you were, when we were talking offline a while back, you had, I expressed that, and that when they're in full color, they don't even look like the same fish to me. I mean,
no, they don't. They don't
look like
either.
A totally different fish, which was amazing.
Well,
to me,
as they're spawning, they're like a lot of fish. You know, most fish in spawning change in both shape and color. Well, their heads sort of elongate, particularly the males. And so I think that does, you know, the coloration, and then also it almost looks like their head shape actually does change somewhat. And I think that's what accounts for that feeling that everybody has. They'll say, you know, this isn't the same fish. You know, or I'll have a group and people will be fishing, and someone will catch a dolly that's not yet in spawning colors, and then someone else will catch a dolly, you know, in spawning colors. And, yeah, people have a hard time believing those two are the same fish.
Right, right. Well, they and their feeding habits are pretty much like trout as well, right? I mean,
what
are the standard methods you fish for dollies? Nymphing?
Well, just like anything almost else that swims, when the salmon are in the river, we put on things that imitate salmon eggs, or we'll fish with a little fly that's called a bunny fly, or it's called a flesh fly, but what it is just a little bunny strip, kind of a yucky-colored off-white sort of bunny strip that we just make a little weighted bunny fly out of to imitate the rotting salmon flesh. And, heck, that'll take dollies just as well as it'll take rainbows and grayling and cutthroat and whatever. See, then in the spring, the dollies are always, too, right, almost first in line. It's kind of like you can see them often. They're jockeying for position with the big lake trout and the big rainbows as the salmon smolts start to come out, out of the tributary creeks, too. So
well,
we just use a fly that imitates the salmon smolt. There are a variety of them.
Yeah, yeah. That was the other interesting thing. When we were on that side creek fishing for the dollies that day, we would have to drift through the kings that were finishing up, because this was in August, and they were still in the river. But we'd have to drift through the kings to get to the dollies, which are all piled up behind the kings in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, you'd bump one of these kings and inevitably snag one once in a while. And so you're on a lighter weight gear, so the first thing you do is break them off as soon as you can, because you don't want that king on a 5-weight rod or something.
That's exactly right. It happens all the time.
I just thought it was comical that I'm floating through 50-pound fish to get to these dollies that are behind. Of course, the kings are, you know, they're not too interesting at that point because they're finishing up and they're weak.
We call them scuzzy.
When
they get to that point, we call them scuzzy, because they're still beautiful in their own way, and to just sit and watch them is amazing. But you know that what they provide in the way of nutrients,
right,
for the health of the river and the health of all the other fish is just amazing, just amazing.
Well, time to take another break here, Pudge. So we'll
okay.
be right back. Are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit could generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or in the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Eliamna and entire Bristol Bay Area waters may be at stake. If you have not already, acquaint yourself with the concerns. You can make a big difference, and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.bristolbayalliance.com or Google Bristol Bay Mining. And if you know of other conservation issues like this, bring them to our attention, and we'll make everybody aware of them. So get involved, be proactive, and help protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. Again, go to www.bristolbayalliance.com. And we'll hopefully talk a little bit more about that if we have time, Butch.
Yes, I would like to, yes.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pudge Kleinkopf about Alaska's other fish. If you'd like to ask Pudge a question, just go to our homepage, fill in the text box there, send it over to us, and we'll try to answer it tonight on our show. Well, let's talk briefly about lake trout.
I was thinking we've still got kind of lake trout and pike and grayling. Lake trout are just really in a lot of Alaska's big lakes. You know, we have some huge lakes, and we have a lot of lake trout in them. Now, the state record lake trout is 47 pounds, so that's just a small one, right? There certainly have been, I've heard of people, catching 60-pounders, and so there are some of those around. They, like lake trout, most everywhere, at least I really, when I target them, it's almost always more in the spring. As I say, they're right there at the mouths of the creeks for the little salmon smolt in kind of usually mid to late June. So, you know, when there's lake trout in a lake, you can find them more easily in the spring. They cruise a little more of the shallows in the spring to fish, and they do that everywhere, not just in Alaska. See, and then, as I say, they'll just stack up right, you know, where the smolt are out migrating, you know, to go on down out to the sea. So lake trout are really fun, and believe it or not, actually, when we're fishing for them when they're after the smolt, we're not using like sink tip lines at all. People think, oh my God, how can you? You got to fish a lake trout on a sink tip line. Actually, no, you don't. In the spring, often a floating line with a little smolt imitation will just do amazing things with them. They can run really quite shallow at that time of the year. But we use I use actually a lot of the same kind of flies that I use for pike. Often. Big flies, one aughts, two aughts, except when we're imitating the little smolt. Boy, and then you got to look just like the little smolt. So if the little smolt is only 2.5 inches long, then that's what your fly better be, is just 2.5 inches long. But they're found actually quite widely, and in a lot of the big lakes. There's three or four large lakes around near Fairbanks that are just fantastic lake trout fishing. And then there's wonderful lake trout fishing as well out in various areas of Bristol Bay. If people want to target a specific species like that, you'd be smart to go to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's website. You can just Google Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and it will come right up. They've got the state divided into areas and sections, and then they'll tell you what are the predominant species in an area, and they've got a nice the lists of recommended locations and names of lakes and rivers and that sort of thing. So the other thing people forget to do is, if they're coming to Alaska, email ahead and get copies of the fishing regulations, because the fishing regulations have in it for you all of the information that you really want about that here's what the limit is for these fish in this area, and there's lake trout, and you'll see then, and there's a whole list of lakes, and so that gives you an amazing amount of information about where to go and what to fish for.
Now, people who are too,
and the time of year, yes.
Season.
Now, people who are coming to Alaska, if they don't drive, they often don't know about this particular book. And anybody who wants to fish in Alaska should get a copy of the Alaska Milepost. It's the book that's actually the mile by mile, when you travel the road system. It's also got an amazing amount of fishing information in it. So that every place along the road where you can stop, it'll say, here's such and such a lake, and it'll have lake trout and dollybard and char and whatnot. So it's not just a useful tool for people who are driving to the state of Alaska. It's got some other really very good information in it as well. But the Alaska Department of Fish and Game website is really kind of the primo place that people should start.
Great. Okay, how about steelhead?
All right, well, as I said earlier, we don't have any summer steelhead in Alaska. We have some runs, mostly, I think, more in the southeast part of the state, that are spring runs of steelhead. We've got a number of those, but none of the runs is very large. And often they're hard to access. There are several companies now down in southeast Alaska that are going steelhead fishing off of mother boats, mother ships, where the ship, you sleep and the ship drives at night, and then they drive you kind of from little small tributary to small tributary, and then you get into a Zodiac or something and go to shore during the day to fish. And there's several of those operations that are targeting, some of the steelhead fishing along the rivers that, dump mostly into the ocean, along in southeast, so that people can access some of those where the run may be 300 fish, 350 fish, just small runs. But there are quite a lot of them. And then we have, we have some rivers that also have fall runs. But, yeah, there are some fall runs of steelhead. They're not really huge either. But there's one that I think most people know about in the Anchor River down on the Kenai Peninsula south of Anchorage. The run kind of begins to, fish begin to trickle in usually in, like, early October. And then it'll go, there'll be fish in, you know, until, I mean, it's freezing up down there, and people are standing down there, and there's ice and snow on the river, and, you know, people are still standing there because it, you know, there's that's a pretty good run down there. So our steelhead, though, are not, as I say, we don't have huge runs really anywhere, you know, huge bunches like a lot of the big rivers do in, like, Oregon and Washington. And but we do have some steelhead. Yeah. So
Larry Anderson in Michigan asks, is there any interest in steelhead up there? Let's extend this question. And do people come up for steelhead, or is that more of a thing you do on the side?
Well, I think it's not easy to do on the side, and the fish, you know, just as I say, if they were there in the summer, see, then it'd be easier to have them on the side. But since they're not, I think, you know, people are more apt to actually to come up for steelhead. But more when they do that, then it's more for the spring fish, I think, than for the fall fish.
And in the southeast, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we got two more to go here. Let's talk about pike, and then let's save one of the best for last, the grayling, okay?
Okay.
All right. Talk
about
pike.
Well, there's lots of pike in Alaska, and people just don't realize that, but there are. And, like, let's go back to Naknek Lake, for instance. You know, that is a massive lake, I think it's in the top 10 of size in the state of Alaska. And, you know, pike there they're natural there. I mean, they're part of the ecosystem, and they're part of the whole balance of the lake. And so, you know, people who enjoy fishing for pike, you know where they are and which lakes contain them. And as I say, you can find that information on the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's website as well. And like the Minto Flats. I mean, the Minto Flats is famous in the state of Alaska for pike fishing. And so people like pike, and now pike is a species that can be fished, yeah, kind of like on the side. See, for instance, let's say you were going to maybe the Brooks River to go sockeye fishing, and then maybe the fishing wasn't so hot, or the sockeye weren't in yet. Heck, you could take a boat there and just go fish for the day and fish pike and lake trout. So you know, a lot of people do that, but they fish them kind of here more as kind of an incidental fish. I don't think too many people really target just pike as the primary species like they would in maybe the upper Midwest.
Yeah, or in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Manitoba, yep. That kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Harry in Troy, Michigan wants to know what the best weight rod to take up with you for pike.
I fish with an 8-weight. I fish with a 9-foot 8-weight. Pretty much always. Although we've been out a couple times on some tributaries to the Kuskokwim, and I have to tell you, those pike out there put my 8-weight to the test, and I was standing there a couple times wishing I had my 10-weight. So an 8 or a 10. Now, some people do come up with 10-weights because 10-weight will be the rod you'll want if you're going to come and fish for kings on a fly as well.
Okay.
So, now, like everywhere, pike want great big flies. The flashier, the better. And you're missing a lot of fun in Alaska if you don't fish subsurface for pike. You know, people get into the, you know, doing the big poppers and mice and stuff on the surface for pike. But a big barbell, eyeball fly, you know, long, kind of natural color, yellows, whites, off-whites, like brown hackle, light brown hackle, or bunny, long bunny tails and stuff, will take a lot of pike under the surface.
And what time of year for pike up there?
Pretty much any time. Like everywhere, the pike tend to be a little more accessible in the spring because that's when they spawn, and they come in more, you know, into the shallow areas of some of these really, really, really big lakes. But pretty much anywhere and any time you can find weed beds. We fish pike. I mean, you can fish them in August, in September. You just, you know, find the line of, you know, the weed line and stuff, and then just start trolling there and see if you can pick them up, or just cast big poppers or big mice flies just right on the surface of the wheat beds.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we fish them year-round.
Great, great. Okay, Arctic grayling, one of the prettiest fish around, I think.
My favorite. Yeah, they are. They are the most beautiful fish. And many people have come to Alaska and have never heard of Arctic grayling, have never seen them, know nothing about them, until, like, accidentally, they're salmon fishing or they're rainbow fishing, and they catch one, and then they say, "Oh my golly, what is this?" And because they aren't, you know, they just don't exist really anywhere but here in Canada, and so people just don't know about them, I think. But it's once people get educated about them, that's what I'm writing my next book on, Roger.
Oh, great.
But once people see them and get the chance to fish for them and learn to appreciate them, now we're beginning to see some people who are coming here, like they have been going for years to Canada, specifically for Arctic grayling. See, that's been a fishery in Canada for years, a target fishery. But, see, not so much here, and again, because we got all this other stuff. But now, as more and more people are learning about grayling, we're finding people coming to Alaska now specifically for grayling as well.
Right, right. And where are they found, again?
Well, they're found pretty much all over the northern part of the state. There's very few in southeast, and there's just a very few around Anchorage. There's a few, but not very many. And there's a few down on the Kenai Peninsula. Now, there are some in both the Anchorage area and Kenai, but they're not wild fish. There are some that are planted fish. And so the wild fish are pretty much west into the Bristol Bay area, and then all the way up, all the way to the North Slope, up
that
whole western side of Alaska. Yes, their water has to be very, very cold, and it has to be absolutely pure. The least pollution, and the grayling are gone. They won't tolerate that, or they die. So they're not a huge fish, again, which, you know, you have to appreciate them for their beauty and for their eagerness to take a dry fly and for the what sport they are and what an amazingly unique fish they are. They can survive. They can winter over, Roger. I don't know if you knew that, in places where no other fish can survive. That blows my mind, you know. And they're a small fish, and so you don't appreciate them because, trophies anything over 18 inches. And so you don't love Arctic grayling because you get these 40-pound trophies, but you appreciate them for lots of other reasons.
That same day we were fishing for the dollies that I was talking about earlier. I just happened to, I got a fish on, and I knew it felt different. It just wasn't like everything else I caught that day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one grayling I had caught on the trip, and not that I was targeting it. It just, was a incidental grayling, and it was an 18-inch fish, so I was rather proud of that fish.
Oh, you should.
It was a nice little present on the end of the line when you bring it in, and you go, oh, my gosh, look what we got here.
I know it. You just they're just stunning in their beauty. There's just nothing else that looks quite like that. And of course, the larger they get, the more beautiful they get. They're aqua and fuchsia colored, and often golden, and with maybe a purple sheen to them. They are really just an amazing fish. Now they are truly Alaska's dry fly fish.
Yeah,
absolutely. Far and away, they are our dry fly fish, because even when they join the trout and the char feeding on salmon eggs and salmon flesh, they never stop taking dry flies and nymphs.
Oh, great for the dry fly fishers. Mike in Duluth, Minnesota asks here, what is your favorite dry fly for the grayling?
Well, I go back and forth between, in Alaska pretty much, I think the A number one is Elkhair caddis. But that would be followed, because we have many more caddis than we have, we have stoneflies, but they're often very tiny, and they're not as big a food source for our fish at CN, and we don't have mayflies nearly as dispersed around as you do, and we don't have all the different subspecies of mayflies either. They just can't survive up here in the winter. But so I would say that that an elk ear caddis is pretty closely followed by probably a parachute adams. And for grayling, believe it, you generally don't need anything much smaller than a size 12 or maybe a 14. So that isn't small, believe me, not,
no.
You know, compared to what you fish in the lower 48. But,
oh, right, 22.
But they are very much, I mean, people say they're pushovers. They are not pushovers. You have to, they want a dead drift fly, by golly. And you know, you've got to learn, you know, how to do that. They're not leader shy in the sense that, I love them partly because I always say for my clients particularly, they'll wait until you get it right. They'll stay right there until you can manage, you know, a proper mend and, you know, and or a proper, you know, S-cast or, you know, whatever. But, and they don't. See, like, you know, a trout will leave, but grayling will stay right there and keep right on feeding, showing you where the feeding lane is. You know, it's not like you have to figure, it's not too hard to figure out because the rises are really quite evident. They are a wonderful fish, but they can be very, very picky, and I think sometimes they do that on purpose just to make sure we don't take them for granted.
Yeah. Mike in Ames, Iowa says, grayling used to be native in the rivers in northern Michigan, but are now extinct from this area. Mm-hmm. Do you know if there are any efforts to restore habitats or reintroduce this beautiful fish down in the lower 48? You had just mentioned that a little bit ago, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You had mentioned a little bit ago, I think, you said in Montana they were trying to do something.
Yes, there's a tiny little remnant population in Montana that is wild. Apparently, that have been the state of Montana's been trying to get them on the endangered species, you know, list down there, and I mean a few things like that, and to preserve them and to get you know the water, and they're not being really successful, but there have also been attempts in, like, Michigan and Wisconsin and, you know, some of the upper Midwest states, the two or three where they used to be grayling, to reintroduce them. And the ones I've read about have not been successful pretty much at all. So I don't know whether, you know, I think they speculate that it's probably partly maybe warming of the water, maybe pollution up there. You know, I don't know. But there has not, and I don't know if they even still are trying to reintroduce grayling up into the upper Northwest, because I think the efforts haven't been successful.
Yeah, they made an attempt here years ago in Colorado in a little small timberline lake. I think it was Zimmerman Lake, and I don't think that was successful either. I haven't heard much about it ever since, but I think it's a tough one. Like you say, they're sensitive, and they want that real cold water, and tough to get going. Mm-hmm. Well, Pudge, we're running out of time here, but I do want to ask you about the Pebble Mine thing up there. We've got a couple questions came in from Scott, who's I know Scott's involved heavily with this. He's with the Alliance and trying to protect that area. And then Kevin Brady in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, also asks about the controversy up there. Can you give us a quick rundown on what's going on and what your take on that whole thing is?
Well, in a word, it's awful. It is going to be devastating. It's just unbelievable that the state of Alaska would even entertain this. But, you know, our previous governor made a big effort to open up everything, to mining and development, and, you know, and so this is part of the price that we pay. Well, unfortunately, there's a heck of a lot of gold up there. Now, you know, I, for one, can't ever see what gold is much useful for, but anyway, you know, it makes some people rich, I guess.
You can't tie flies with it, right?
That's right. But it makes some people rich, so I guess that's all it takes. But what I think is important that I want to say, Roger, before we end, is that people in the lower 48 must help us. We Alaskans, there's only half of us about, you know, who are going to fight the Pebble Mine, and the other half either don't care or, you know, think all development is good development. But people in the lower 48 think it's just an Alaska problem, or they think, well, we can't do anything because it's all up to Alaska. Well, actually, it's not. Part of that land up there that's going to be affected is federal land, and part of the permits that they're going to have to get are from the federal government. So we need people to all write their own senator and their own congressman and say, you know, you need to stand for, you know, protecting some of this kind of resource, and that, you know, you need to make sure that the federal government just doesn't, you know, roll over and you know, approve those the leases and stuff up there as well, because it is just going to be devastating. It's in the headwaters of three or four of the major salmon rivers in Bristol Bay. It's going to be awful.
There's also an article in the latest Fly Fish America magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes. And Trout Unlimited has gotten very involved as well. And people should also go. There's some very good information on the Trout Unlimited site. And the article, it's More Precious Than Gold, I believe is the title of the article. And as I recall, I think that's available and preprint and reprinted there on the TU website too.
And then again, the Alliance website, BristolBayAlliance.com, if you want to learn more about this as well. And I want to throw a little anecdote in there as well. I went up with my dad pike fishing in northern Manitoba. I guess it's been 2 years since we went up there. This is way up on the Kissimmee Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Kissimmee
mm-hmm.
Lake, something like that. I'm probably not pronouncing it right. But the guy took us over one evening when we were just, you know, had nothing to do, and took us to this area and showed us this open mining area that had been mined some 30-plus years ago.
Yeah.
And this area, which was probably, you know, 100 acres or so up there, I'm guessing, hadn't been touched since they quit. There wasn't, in that area, there wasn't one weed growing in the dirt there.
Mm-hmm.
That whole area was barren. There wasn't anything growing there. The lake that was down hill from that was all this kind of amber looking color,
mm-hmm.
and nothing will grow there after 30 years.
It's all poisoned.
The land is, and they're trying to get that restored, and it's almost impossible to restore it.
Mm-hmm.
They killed the dirt.
Exactly. And it's going to be worse than that. Pebble is proposed to be the largest open pit gold mine in North America.
Wow.
Well,
we got to stop that. So everybody out there, help out as best you can. And
please, yes.
Yeah. So, well, hang in there, Pudge. I'll be right back to you. I'm going to do a quick commercial, and then we're going to give away some prizes tonight. So.
Okay, and answer the question.
Yeah, and answer a question. I'll have to think of a good question here.
Okay.
Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com, or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. Okay, just a quick note before we get into our giveaway here. Before you leave our website tonight, please go to our homepage there, and right under Pudge's section there, gives you an opportunity to leave some comments about our show. We'd love to hear what you have to think about it. Let us know what you think, and put your comments in there. Okay, a lot of things to give away tonight. So let me go to my drawing button here. And folks, to be involved in these drawings, you have to have registered on our site prior to the show or during the show. And so now it's a little bit too late, but be sure to do it next time, and we give away a lot of nice things. So the first thing we're going to give away is a 3-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers. And so I'm going to press my magic button, and we've got Penny Dobb in California. And so congratulations, Penny, on that 3-year membership. And it's always a great thing to have a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. So. And then our second giveaway is a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. Now, Fly Fusion magazine is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and they're making a big impact down here in the U.S. as well, so
mm-hmm.
opening up their market there. Nice magazine. And our winner there is Stephen Bonner in New Mexico. Stephen Bonner in New Mexico. So congratulations, Penny and Stephen, on those two gift items. And now our big gift items tonight that Pudge has so graciously donated for our drawing is her first book, Fly Fishing Women Explore Alaska, and she's also giving out a hat and fly box. So, Pudge, you tell me when to press the button so that you pick the winner here.
Go.
Okay. Don Rybergard in California. So, Don, congratulations. And we have your email here, but I will be emailing you folks that are winners to get your information so that, and especially in this case of Pudge having to mail this down to you and so forth. So we want to get your good information. By the way, Pudge's book has a lot of great patterns for flies for Alaska. So if you're thinking about going up there, it's a great book to have just for the patterns in the back. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy that, Don. Congratulations. And now your turn again, Pudge, for the copy of River Girls, Fly Fishing for Young Women. And if you're a guy, you might like to read this and if for sure pass it on to a young lady that has potential to fly fish, and we're always wanting to bring young people into the sport. So, again, Pudge, you tell me when.
Okay, well, to start with, that's a good beginner's book for anybody. So,
for anybody, great.
For anybody. Okay, so hit the button now.
Okay. Brian Adams in California. Oh, California is doing well tonight.
Yeah, big, yeah.
Brian Adams, congratulations on winning Budge's book and a hat and a fly box as well. So everybody enjoy your gifts tonight. I'm sure you will, and thanks for participating in our drawing. Okay, here's your question. Now go to our homepage. There's a text box there you're going to fill out. Be sure you put your name and your location. If you don't do that, it won't count, okay? So the question is, which fish is probably the most sensitive to the quality of water, dealing with pollution and so forth, and prefers the coldest water up there? Which fish is that? And the first person that gives us our answer here online will win a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. So I'm anxiously awaiting an answer here. And
does a board light up or something?
Yeah,
when the first one comes in?
I have to keep refreshing my screen here, and then as soon as somebody types one in, then we get come on now, that wasn't a very hard question, was it, Pudge?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I knew the answer right off.
Here we go. Whoa. Phil Panko in Kaysen, Minnesota says she fish. What do you say, Pudge?
Nope.
Wasn't right, Phil. You can try again, Phil. Oh. Here, Brian Whiting in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, the grayling.
That's it.
So, Brian, you...
Yeah.
And he's in Colorado, so you can come down and collect your prize directly at the Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Brian. And actually, we're going to be talking with Brian in the next couple months. We're talking about doing a show with him because he's going to tell us all about how to plan a trip to Alaska from the... fly fisher's point of view, not from the guide's point of view. So he's done a trip up there with his kids, and it thought it'd be an interesting show. So kind of a follow-up to this show. So everybody should enjoy that. Well, congratulations, everybody, on winning tonight. And I know you're going to enjoy the prizes, and thanks for listening in. Well, Pudge, thank you for joining us again. We really appreciate the time you take with us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and it was really a lot of fun talking about so many different fish on one show. So thanks for sharing your time and experiences and your knowledge with us tonight.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I've enjoyed every single second.
Yeah, well, maybe we can talk about something more specific next time in Alaska and explore Alaska. It sounds like a lot to explore up there. So.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, on our next broadcast, which will be on November 21st at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, we will be interviewing Tom Whiting, and our topic for the show will be Hackle, Facts About Feathers. Tom Whiting is president and owner of Whiting Farms, producer of the finest fly tying feathers for the tires of the world, and will share his knowledge about those wonderful feathers we use every day. From raising chickens to the science behind genetic breeding, to selecting proper hackle to use on your flies. Tom will be covering it all in great detail on our show. This is going to be a much different show than we normally have, but you're going to learn everything you wanted to know about hackle and probably some things you didn't want to know. So tune in. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Platte River Fly Shop, Family Ties, and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site as well. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.